From WNYC New York Public Radio, I'm Leonard Lopate. This is just one segment of the Leonard Lopate Show, but every interview is available on demand at WNYC.org. This on-demand service is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org.
WNYC On Demand is supported by Open, how American Express serves small business. Open offers a range of products and services designed exclusively for small business. Details at 888-779-OPEN or open.com.
You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
In his 2003 State of the Union address, President Bush firmly stated that Saddam Hussein possessed weapons of mass destruction in the form of mobile labs designed to produce germ warfare agents. However, the intelligence the president relied on for his speech and used to justify the invasion of Iraq was provided by a source with the codename Curveball. He was actually a heavy-drinking Iraqi taxi driver and con artist. In On the Brink, an insider's account of how the White House compromised American intelligence, Tyler Drumheller, then the CIA European Operations Chief, recounts how he repeatedly warned his superiors not to trust Curveball's reports. The book is published by Philip Turner, an imprint of Carolyn Graf. It is my great pleasure to welcome Mr. Drumheller to my show today.
Thank you very much.
What positions did you hold within the CIA before you retired?
Well, they limit what I can tell you exactly, but I was...
You're limited in that, too?
Yes. I ended up as chief of clandestine operations for Europe and the directorate of operations, which is the spying part of the CIA. Before that, I was the chief of what was then the largest station in the world, before Baghdad was stood up. And then before that, I served in a couple of other large European stations. I served in Eastern Europe and then in Southern Africa for many, many years.
And mostly rather invisibly. Why did you decide, as you put it, to come out into the light?
Well, it was at the end of this period with the run-up to the war, when it became clear that we were going to be the scapegoats for what was really a policy decision, the administration had every intention. They were already thinking about doing this in early 2001, even when they came into office. Now, we were told to start preparing, to start gearing up for reporting on Iraq. But when it became clear after things had gone wrong, and we had actually warned them about the possible problems, and it occurred to me that I had to say something on behalf of the officers who risked their lives and to gather this reporting and to do the work. And also, it's a tale for the future. Because you have a very similar situation was building up in Iran now. So I think it's both to sort of a debt that I owe to the officers that worked for me and then for the future.
Do you think that Iran has been put on hold because of the election last week?
It seems to be. I mean, the appointment of Bob Gates to be the Secretary of Defense, Gates is former director of the agency, deputy director, longtime senior analyst at the agency, he's been outspoken in his belief that we need to engage Iran rather than continue to look at it as a military solution first. And I think that Gates is a very smart guy. There are some analysts that don't like him because he was kind of a tough guy to work for, but he's a very, very smart guy. And they realize that, first off, a war with Iran would be a disastrous mistake right now. Secondly, really the purpose of an intelligence service is to prevent wars, not to start wars and not to foment wars. And so I think that Gates sees that and that you really only go to war when you've got no other option because there's no way of predicting what's going to happen, like now.
You suggested earlier that there are certain things you can't reveal, and this book has been vetted, and every so often you have to say,
yes.
Well, I can't tell you what this is because I've been told not to.
Right.
That must have been frustrating.
Well, it was about a year and a half. Now, as my wife has pointed out to me, this was sort of payback for all the times that I had to vet books and I took things out of them when I was in my old job. But you always think that you vetted it yourself. But what they are looking for is that you're not exposing any active operations or agents situations like that. But there was a little complication in the middle, I think, during the Porter Goss period, because I left. One of the reasons I left the agency, not the reason I left wrote the book, but one of the reasons I left the agency was I felt after 30 years that I didn't want to have to put up with what was going on under Porter. And so I think there was some hostility in there. I will say the review board did a good job. They're pretty straightforward. I know some of my other friends, Gary Berens and others, wouldn't agree with me, but the review board did their part. The problem lies in the division, in the operational divisions, because what happens is you submit the book to the review board, they send it out to the different parts of the agency that it deals with, and it can languish there. That's it.
When Porter Goss took over, he said that the agency had real problems and he was going to turn it around. And I guess all of the old-timers felt that it didn't need correcting. But hasn't the CIA had some problems?
It has real problems. That's part of that's the real tragedy.
But you thought that Porter Goss was not attacking
it correctly?
That's
the tragedy of Porter Goss, is that I think Porter even realized what the problems were. And there are problems that it sounds sort of boring when you're talking about the CIA. There's the problems with the way the budget works, the way it relates to the Pentagon, the way it relates to the political establishment in Washington, the way the personnel system works. All these things are very important. Most of them are left over from the Cold War and have been sort of patched and fiddled with through the late 90s, but weren't really addressed because it's a hard thing to do and people don't like doing it. When Porter came in, he had the chance to do that because he came completely from the outside. I mean, he was on the intelligence committee, but he had worked at the agency 40 years ago. But he came from the outside. But what happened instead was, and this is one of the things that is, I think, when you talk about politicizing the agency, he was bought in, I don't think, to fix the agency. He was bought in to punish the people that were, or not punish, but to deal with what they thought was a disloyal agency because they weren't being told what they wanted to hear.
So what do you think is the best way for the CIA to restructure to fight the war on terror? Because it seems to still be structured in a way to fight the Cold War.
It is. And what they've done to set up for the war on terror doesn't, and the modern world of non-state enemies really hasn't. What they've done is they've made the Washington element much, much larger. The field stations and the officers out in the field are still doing great work. But what has happened with the creation of the Director of National Intelligence structure, you've got a huge, bloated 1,700-man bureaucracy put on top of the agency's already bloated Washington bureaucracy. You really need to cut out all those staff people. You have operations people, analysts, a minimal staff around the agency. When I joined the agency way long time ago, the standard line was that there was never more than two or three people between any officer in the field and the director. And the director, you felt, had responsibility for what you were doing and was backing you up. Now going to see the director is like going to see the Wizard of Oz. I mean, that's it. So you can't, and then to go see the DNI structure is a completely artificial setup. But it does give them a mechanism. At first, I was totally opposed to it, but if they got rid of all the staff people, and the Pentagon has no shortage of brigadier generals and rear admirals to plug into jobs at the DNI office, but get rid of all those, and have a very small elite executive structure, put all the human intelligence, the espionage, classical espionage services, under one leader. Now they've got a structure for that. The national they call it the National Human Clandestine Service, but it really is only the old director of operations of the agency and a few other things. They don't really have control over what collection units in the Pentagon are used. So bringing all that together, put all the analysts in one place. And don't bring all the analysts from every analytical section. Bring the very best. Bring the best people from academia. Make it sort of like the Manhattan Project. You know, you got, if we, you know, we built nuclear weapons, we put men on the moon, we should be able to organize an analytical staff. And any good university could do that.
And then listen to what they say.
And then listen to what they say and not... And when they tell you things you don't want to hear, not interpret that as being disloyal. And then the rest of it, you make the structure smaller, more organized, and it'll be smaller, cheaper, and better able to deal with the situations as they come up.
My guest is Tyler Drumheller, who is the former chief of CIA clandestine operations in Europe. He's written, with the help of Elaine Monahan, On the Brink, an insider's account of how the White House compromised American intelligence, published by Carol and Graf, the Philip Turner imprint. So that whole business about being punished for telling the story the way the politicians don't want to hear it, is that something new, or hasn't that always been a problem with the CIA?
It's always lurking in the background. I think at least since the mid-70s. I remember the agency came out of the OSS in World War II, and we were talking earlier about... before we started, about Richard Helms.
But wasn't even Lyndon Johnson upset sometimes when the CIA gave him information you want to hear?
And that's always been the case. But they, in the end, they tended, even when they didn't believe it at first, they tended, when they saw that it was true, to take it. Johnson eventually realized at the end that the agency was right, that they couldn't win, that the North Vietnamese were too deeply embedded. I saw it myself in dealing with South Africa in the Reagan administration, in that the Reagan administration, when it came into office, saw everything very much, and they were every bit as political as these guys, but they were a little more, maybe a little more experienced in some ways than they, but they saw the problem of South Africa not as apartheid government oppressing the holding down the black citizens of South, the black South Africans. Instead, they saw it as an extension of the Cold War. The ANC is trained by the KGB, and there were links. There was, because that's who they turned to for their allies. But it was a much, much more complex problem, and they really sort of looked at the apartheid officials as being sort of just regular guys that maybe were a little off track, and we can bring them back into line. And it was only, and I think our reporting through the 80s and into the 90s, really, they took it to heart. They didn't like it. They really didn't like it. But they took it to heart, and you saw changes made in the policy. And while they never really came out and said it, they allowed certain things to change, and they began to pressure the South Africans. And I think the agency's reporting played a major role in the – it wasn't the only role, but played a major role in the end of apartheid.
Working with the intelligence that it had, was there anything the CIA could have done to have prevented the attacks of 9/11?
It is – possible. Working with the intelligence they had, if the coordination between the Counterterrorism Center and the FBI had been more efficient, what they call Alex Station, the Bin Laden group at the Counterterrorism Center, but there were the case of the two fellows that came through Los Angeles and their visas weren't screened properly and all that. And there, but again, that's looking at hindsight. They weren't really. There was no real detailed reporting from inside these cells, and that's the nature of terrorism. You're not going to probably penetrate a group like Mohammed Atta's group. What you need to do is draw on the resources of, in this case, would have been the German police and
you mean old Europe?
Old Europe,
not
yes.
Rumsfeld is called.
That's right, and say who might come to you and say, there is somebody, and there's a group of guys here, they're a little more dangerous, they have a little more money, and then you might pay attention to it. And you would stop it, but the thing is, you'd never know you stopped. Now, we don't know how many attacks we've stopped, because terrorist attacks, you know, don't take place. You don't know what's happened.
But what about the much talked about at the time rivalry between the FBI and the CIA as a problem in perhaps... being more aware of what was of these attacks?
It's an old rivalry. It goes back to the founding of the agency and the FBI being much older. But they at the time, I would characterize it more than a rivalry. It was just, it was more of people had fallen into bad habits of protecting information, saying, well, we're not going to share this with the FBI for this reason, for whatever reasons. There were always reasons to protect information. And it was a bureaucratic, and it was, again, it was like the Cold War, treating it, reporting that as if it were something on a KGB case in the Cold War, as opposed to a terrorist case, where really, the thing with the terrorist case, you have to get everybody. You have a great system here in New York. The police, New York police, have a fantastic counterterrorist system, one of the, probably better than what the national government has, and where they can sort of feed in everything. And that's what you really need. They
if one guy isn't telling the other one, then right. neither of them get the complete picture.
And it's better now, but it needs constant work. It just, again, this is one of the things I think where it needs to be smaller, because the more people you have in the system, the more chance you have of messing up.
But there are even differences in philosophy. For example, the CIA seems to be much more open to the use of torture than the FBI. The FBI thinks it's counterproductive.
Well, I mean, it depends on who you talk to in the CIA. I wouldn't say that torture is productive. I think there may be situations where if it's an immediate attack and maybe it works. But the problem is, if you were to use torture, and again, I'm not supposed to talk about this. This is one of the things they took out of the book. But it is.
Well, you have a philosophy.
It doesn't really work, because you don't know what the person's told you, and people will tell you anything to make it stop. So they have, and I think it weakens us as a service, because when we sit and debate it, I mean, I talk to some of the old war horses of the agency that are retired, and they were really, and these are not great liberals. These are the guys that fought the Cold War and everything. They were appalled by this debate that we're debating in Congress, whether to torture people or not, or whether to, you know, what is torture, what isn't. It's almost, you know, it's not something that you see in American, you expect to see in American politics.
My guest is Tyler Drumheller, retired from the CIA and early 2005, after a career that spanned more than 25 years, where he serves as the chief of the agency's largest field office and worked as a senior operations officer in other regions of the world. He has written a book called On the Brink with the help of Elaine Monahan. It's subtitled An Insider's Account of How the White House Compromised American Intelligence, published by Philip Turner imprint of Carroll and Graff. We will continue our conversation after this. We're back with Tyler Drumheller, Drumheller, former chief of CIA clandestine operations in Europe, and author of On the Brink, an insider's account of how the White House compromised American intelligence, published by the Philip Turner imprint of Carroll and Graff. After 9/11, did the White House instruct the CIA to look for a link between the attacks by Osama bin Laden and Saddam Hussein?
I don't believe they specifically instructed. I never heard them specifically instruct anybody to do it, but they made it clear that they believed there was a link. And in the way, I mean, the CIA is a bureaucracy like any bureaucracy, and people want to please their bosses after a while. And there were people in the agency who were convinced that there was this link.
The 1%, Ron Susskind's book.
Susskind's book, yeah.
He says that Cheney's office would go to the CIA and ask for a link, and the CIA would say no, and then they go back and ask for it again. And eventually, after the 35th time vetting the State of the Union address, the CIA finally said okay.
And that's what I mean when I say there was never direct pressure, but it was this constant, well, you haven't found it yet. Where's the link? And they became focused on the supposed meeting between Atta and an Iraqi intelligence officer in Prague, which was based on a report that was just a sort of a miscommunication from the Czech service way back. And but there are still people in the government today who absolutely believe this and believe that if you don't believe it, you're crazy. You know, you're not.
How did the CIA director, George Tenet, deal with the White House's pressure on CIA intelligence gathering?
I think from 2000, from the election up through 9/11, George was in sort of a learning mode with the administration. In the summer of 2001,
had he been more effective under Bill Clinton?
He was much more part of the Clinton administration. I don't think he expected to stay on. He told me, in fact, he was just waiting for them to pick someone to replace him. And
Ron Suskind suggests that he ran with the intelligence that the White House was asking because he was grateful to still have his job.
Well, when he came back, and when they finally figured out that he wasn't going to be, that they weren't, they had an original plan and it didn't work out, so they asked him to stay, and he had, the president liked him, and so he came back. He was really pleasantly surprised, and I think George, you know, I don't know, be an amateur psychologist, but George is a congressional staffer, that's his whole career, and he had a principal who really appreciated what he was doing. I will say before 9/11, he was one of the few people that was really trying to say what Woodward says in his book is true. I saw Kofor Black and George right after that meeting with Dr. Rice, and Kofor said, we're trying to warn everybody in the administration, nobody will listen to us, and they were really upset. They were clearly trying to make that point. But after 9/11, I think 9/11 hit George very, very hard, like it did all of us, but I think he took it very personally, as if he personally had failed, and then he was working hard after that to make up for that.
Let's talk about the intelligence source named Curveball. Yes. How long did he work with the CIA and other intelligence agencies?
He never really worked with the CIA. He was a German. He was a guy who worked for the. He was an Iraqi who had been he had been an engineer, but just with a very brief career in the Iraqi Ministry of Science and Technology, and he had only a sort of a fleeting association with the type of equipment that might be used for biological weapons. And he was a bit of a flake and a hustler, and he was always getting in trouble for different things.
Had you met him?
No, but he went to Germany after a number of times. He showed up in Germany, wanted to stay in Germany, was clever enough to figure out, as the Germans talked to him, because there was an Iraqi engineer, they said, have you ever had anything to do with biological weapons? And he said, yeah, well, I don't know about biological weapons, but I worked at this one place, and they built some things. And so the next thing you know, the Germans were debriefing him. They didn't bring it to us. They had the German intelligence services, the BND is split between military and civilian, and this information they shared with the Defense Intelligence Agency, who then put it out through the community to the CIA. Was a consumer on this one. The part of the CIA is called WINPAC that does the work on this weapons. I forget what the acronym is, but it's WINPAC. And they have and so Curveball produced, I don't know, 120 intel reports, 119 intelligence reports that talked about their biological program, particularly a program to build mobile biological laboratories, which had come to him because of the way he was questioned. They sort of asked leading questions because there had been some rumors. And, in fact, there was some evidence that the Iraqis even had thought about trying to build mobile biological labs. They realized it wouldn't work, or mobile biological production units. And he had worked at a plant that had nothing to do with the actual weapons. It had to do with a real civilian application of the equipment. So he knew he could describe equipment. He could describe in detail valves and pipes and things like that. And he was a clever guy, and he worked all this into a scenario that fed into a sort of a groupthink, a conventional wisdom that was at play in the intelligence community, in the WINPAC, in the agency at the time. And it became the center of all the judgments that were made on Iraqi biological weapons.
My guest is Tyler Drumheller. His book, On the Brink, written with the help of Elaine Monahan, is published by Carol N. Graf. This is WNYC and WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Germany was the source of a lot of the information. There was also the yellow cake document forgeries.
That came out of Italy, though. That was the Italians. But that information actually was information, I believe, there was a guy in Italy trying to make money, and he sold it to a bunch of different services, and they all shared it with each other, practicing what they call the third country rule, not saying who the original source was, and it became the ultimate intelligent analyst nightmare.
But everybody seemed to agree that they were forgeries, except the people in the White House.
Well, because they were looking for, they had this idea that was in place, that Saddam had weapons, that he was a threat, there was a reason to do it. both, you know, geopolitically and defensively. And so they were looking for intelligence to prove an issue, not being driven by the intelligence. And so Curveball's reporting really came in 2000, and 2001, and was eventually what became the heart of the national intelligence estimate that was used as the reason for going to war in a lot of cases.
In fact, a draft of Colin Powell's speech to the United Nations appeared in your division, and there was intelligence based on reports from Curveball. What did you do?
Well, we had, in September, we finally got involved with Curveball in September. They asked us, Deputy Director of Operations, Jim Pavitt, asked us to try and get access, because people were a little nervous about this. They were, because the Germans kept saying they couldn't verify what he was reporting. They were just giving it to us. And to their credit, they never said this is absolutely true. They said, here's what we have, we can't verify it. We got involved in trying to get access, work with the Germans to get access to Curveball and to validate some of the things he was saying. Just operationally, using our as operations officers, who obviously we didn't know enough about the scientific part of it to do, the engineering part of it to do that. But that engendered a horrible debate all through the fall of 2002. I mean, the most violent debate I've ever seen in my years in government, between my officers and the people from the DIA and from WinPEC. And in the end, I believe in early January that we had at least raised enough doubt that they were going to hold off. They wouldn't say that it wasn't true, and we couldn't prove it wasn't true, but they couldn't prove it was true. So the week before the Powell speech, we were given a copy of the speech to validate, to vet. And in there was still a bunch of stuff from Curveball, which we took out, we lined out, and then I took it up. I met with the deputy director, John McLaughlin, went over it with him. He said, oh, this is the only tangible source we have. And they said, well, you know, we really think this guy might be a fabricator. We didn't say he was a fabricator, and that's an important intelligence nuance. But he might be a fabricator, and certainly.
So you left a little door open.
Well, because we hadn't proved it yet, but it certainly did not deserve to go into that speech, and so we thought we'd stopped it.
And then the president gave the State of the Union.
Well, the State of the Union had actually come before that. This debate actually happened after that, because we said we don't want to, you know, it's in the State of the Union. We didn't agree with that, but we weren't given the State of the Union address. Powell's speech then, I thought we had stopped it, and then when I saw it on TV, there it was.
You write that as another agent, somebody you call Bill, tried to vet his own source. He was told that it's time you learned it's not about intelligence anymore, it's about regime change.
That's right. Yeah,
well, told him that?
That was
tell us?
I can't tell you who it was, but it was one of the senior officials, one of the senior officers working on the Iraqi ops, and and this is a fellow who worked directly with the director and with the White House, and that really is maybe reflects best what was going on. I actually talked to somebody right before the war, one of the very senior guys, and I said, you know, you guys sure about this? And they said, no, but when we get to Baghdad, we're going to find warehouses full of this stuff, and nobody's going to care anyway. And they were gambling.
Yeah. You must have alerted George Tenet to your concerns about Curveball's veracity.
Well, George Tenet's his chief of staff and his executive assistant were involved in all these debates, and if you know how the agency works, he was. There's no way I can believe that he wasn't directly told. I told his deputy, John McLaughlin, was an excellent deputy. I'm sure he told George. But the night before the speech, George called me from New York. They were up here. They were, I think, at the Waldorf. And they were trying to get the number of the chief of the British service, because they had some British reporting in the speech that they wanted to tell him they were going to use. And I gave him that. And then after that, I said, you know, boss, this reporting, the German reporting in this, be careful, that German reporting is not still in the speech, because it's really, there's a lot of problems with it. And he said, don't worry about it. It's not a problem. We get, you know.
And how have he and Colin Powell and Condoleezza Rice, for that matter, or anyone else involved, responded to the claims that you warned them about Curveball?
Well, Condoleezza Rice hasn't responded, but and Powell, we didn't warn Powell. I probably, looking back, if I, you know, maybe I should have, but that's, you know, I.
But you were vetting the
thing. I was going through my chain of command, and that was, and so John doesn't remember. John McLaughlin says he doesn't remember, and it's not on his, the meeting's not on his on his calendar. Of course, most of the meetings he had with him aren't on his calendar because they just happen ad hoc. And George says it didn't happen that way, that it was just a short conversation, and that, in fact, if I thought he's a fabricator, I should have written a fabrication memo. And as I said, we didn't say yet that he was a fabricator, but we certainly were worried about it. And he had known me for many, many years and knew that if I brought something up with him like this, that I wouldn't just do it, you know, out of the blue.
When did the media uncover his fabricated intelligence? It must have been leaked by somebody.
That's a good question. I hadn't really thought. It was not too long after that, and I think it was leaked by somebody either in state, probably at State Department, and it was when later in the spring of, I guess it was the spring of 2004, the SSCI, the Senate Select Committee, was looking at this. They didn't get into curveball, but then the Silberman-Robb Commission did, and I think that's when it really started to come out.
Now, Daniel Ellsberg has called for more leaking. He said that the Pentagon Papers may have prevented certain problems in Vietnam, and he wished that he had leaked them earlier with the run-up to a possible war in Iran. He was concerned about that. But what are your feelings about leaks?
I've seen the bad effects of leaks, and I believe there are other ways. I think if you really disagree with something and you just can't deal with it, you have to sort of do what I did. Because when you leak something, you can get it out. You can get it out. You can stop something bad. But you also don't know the knock-on effect, and you may be putting somebody's life at risk somewhere, and you don't even know it. You don't even know what the second and third level sources are on these things.
So, what led you to finally retire from the CIA?
I think it was this. It was this entire episode. The fact that the war was going on. We had had no real effect in it. It was clear that we were becoming mired down in it. And then when Goss came in with the idea that we had somehow failed and Goss was going to straighten us out, and that was, you know, that was the end of that.
Had you ever met Curveball or somebody?
No American has ever met Curveball. There one American who was portraying himself as a German met him one time, but no Americans ever debriefed Curveball until the spring of 2004 when we finally got access to him. We sent a guy, really, probably it'll embarrass him, but I say he is the best field case officer in the agency, who speaks fluent German. They sent him out. He sat down, debriefed him for about 2 weeks, and then came back and said, he's lying. It's fabrication.
Just one more thing, as somebody who has thought a lot about this, do you think that invading countries is a good way to fight terrorism?
No, I think when you have to do, there are times when I think with Afghanistan, they needed to strike a blow against the Taliban. And I think we had an opportunity there, and everybody, even the French and the Germans, all these other countries, saw the rationale in that.
And right now, Afghanistan is in serious trouble.
Because they drew the resources off of Afghanistan for Iraq almost immediately after the fighting began in Afghanistan. But we had a chance. The way you fight terrorism is by building alliances with the allied countries and with non-allied countries. I mean, you have a lot of these, you know, sort of not the friendliest states who don't like terrorists either, and you can work with them, and that's what you have intelligence services for. So you can work under the radar. You don't have to do it publicly, which causes a lot of problems both for that regime and your regime. But you can work to identify and arrest. The Bush administration for a long time sort of scoffed at the idea. They made fun of the idea that used to be in the Clinton administration that this was like a legal problem that you arrest. In fact, it is like a legal problem. These guys are more like criminals than they are like – they're very bad criminals. They're horrible criminals. But they're more like very bad criminals than they are military sources.
Tyler Drumheller's book, On the Brink, An Insider's Account of How the White House Compromised American Intelligence, written with the help of Elaine Monahan, published by Philip Turner Books, an imprint of Carolyn Graff. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me. It's great.
Thanks for listening to the Leonard Lopate Show from WNYC, New York Public Radio. You can hear everything we do and check out our other programs on demand at WNYC.org or on iTunes. This on-demand service is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org. And thanks.